Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us this week. We've got a great show for you here. We're in the brand new year and a lot of things. We've got a guest coming back joining us, BJ Schneider, with his book, Welcome to New Orleans. How many shots did you hear? We're going to be talking about some more of his experiences. We talked about Katrina last time. Now we're going to talk about some major mass casualty incidents that he was involved with in his career there in EMS. And we'll follow up with that here in a second. But, you know, we've got to bring in the co-host above all co-hosts, Sam Bradley.
Oh, it just keeps getting better. Now I'm above all the other co-hosts. It's so good to be the queen. Hi, Jamie. Good to hear from you again. And I hope everybody had a great holiday since we're now pushing into the new year. We have our friend Kevin Ryder here with us, too, who is a New Jersey transplant in Texas doing wilderness training. Hi, Kev.
Howdy, y'all.
Starting to sound
you're
like
working on it. It's sounding a little better every time we have you on the show.
Yeah, a little bit better every time. So we're going to have Kevin here for his perspective. And we have BJ Schneider with us again, like you mentioned. We had an awesome podcast with him earlier talking about his personal experiences, not only being a first responder in Katrina, but as a resident of Katrina, which is something that's just inconceivable to me. But in his long career, BJ's had a lot of experiences. We talked a lot about MCIs, but again, not necessarily from the perspective of people that have been inside them. So BJ, in case somebody missed the last episode, tell us a little about yourself and what you do and what you've done.
No problem. Thanks for having me on. I started my career in the Army doing both typical small-scale medical stuff, and I was a helicopter crew chief. Got out, joined a police department, and had the luxury of having a rescue division as part of that department that asked me to come on board. Got my first EMT training, fell in love with it, and have been part of every rescue division I've had an opportunity to be part of over the years. I've worked for the state of Louisiana in both rescue capacity and both as a policeman. And it seems I'm always in the places when bad things happen. I don't know if it's something about me or what.
We have a name for people like you.
Yes, I wasn't going to say that one out loud.
No, this is a family show, so we know what we're talking about. Well, that's awesome. Your experience, Katrina, just completely blew me away. And we talked about things that I don't think a lot of us as first responders have ever really thought too much about. Like you were talking about having your dogs with you, taking them home, and then the levees broke. And how do we handle people and their animals? And how do you handle your own emotions, you know, even though you know your family's safe? If you haven't listened to that podcast, people, you need to go back and listen to that. I think that's one of the best ones we've ever done that I've certainly been engaged in. And we'll talk a little bit more about the book that BJ wrote supporting that those stories, and I'm sure you're going to want one. But you've had some other interesting experiences in terms of MCIs. What happened on the Riverwalk? Tell us about that one.
The Riverwalk, for those that aren't don't know exactly what it is in 1984, the World's Fair was right along the Mississippi River, right where the bridge crosses in New Orleans from one side of the river to the other. And after the fair, as what happens in most places, they converted the area into something usable, and it became a large mall-type apparatus that ran along the river. It had a large Hilton hotel attached to it, restaurants, and so forth. And this particular day, the ship Brightfield, which was a cargo ship coming down the Mississippi, lost all steerage. And the Mississippi is very windy and twisty, and it was pointed directly at the mall and hotel area, and they could not stop the ship. Pardon me. They dropped anchor, did everything they could, but the ship ended up plowing directly into the side of the mall and taking out a fairly large portion of mall and hotel, causing extremely large amounts of damage to a very highly populated area. This was, I have the years in the book. I think it was 96. I don't really recall, but it was right before Christmas time. So a very populated area, lots of people, lots of craziness, and a several hundred foot long ship plowing into the building.
Oh, who's going to expect that? Not it sounds like worst case scenario time-wise.
Yeah, it definitely. When it was most populated, all these people around, you know, coming into the holidays, I guess the we were very, very lucky in the end. And I say lucky because we live on the Mississippi. We deal with ships all the time. Nobody planned for that event. We'd planned for some sort of impact and these sort of issues, more environmental than a giant. You know, you think of a plane crashing. You don't think of a ship crashing. So you deal with those kind of accidents. But the number of injuries were minimal in comparison to what they could have been. And no reported loss of life from such a tragic event. And it couldn't have asked for a better outcome than that because of it happening.
Well, how did that go? How did the response go? And what was your part in it?
I was working the street that day. And was one of the first units to arrive on the scene. Now, we're talking about a building that's about a mile long, maybe 100 yards wide and a mile long is the mall. So there's not exactly a really good way to systematically check the area. All we could kind of do was bring units in from different ends and try to walk through it to see what we could find and who we could find. That was the best way we could go about it at first. So my partner and I started on the north side of this building and began to work our way down. Everyone, obviously, from the mall had fled and exited, and there was no one around. It was a giant ghost town at that point. Entire stores had fallen into the Mississippi River, where you'd look through the door and a jewelry store had the first counter and everything behind it was gone, just sunlight coming in. Areas where there was still cigarettes sitting in the ashtray or a pipe sitting in an ashtray with smoke coming out of it and nobody around because they had fled from it. Once we had worked our way through the mall, we began to systematically search the hotel rooms that faced the river, going door to door, popping the doors to check the rooms. Probably the most bizarre thing to see is come up, check the door, hit the door with the breaker, pop the door open, and there was absolutely nothing on the other side of the door. The entire room was
gone. Whoa. I can't imagine.
You were looking down into the river and sunlight hit you in the eyes and you go, I don't know what to say about this.
Except we know what you said about that.
Yeah.
We won't say that on the show either. So did people end up in the water, some of them?
We had several people who went in the water. Believe it or not, the majority of the people who ended up in the water were self-inflicted into the water. At the time, there was a river casino boat that was directly in front of where this happened, and there was quite a few people who jumped overboard seeing the ship coming in for impact. I guess it was just a response to flee, and this was the only option they felt they had, and they had to be rescued. I guess thank goodness that the ship crashed upstream from them, and they were carried away from the accident. The hard thing about that was them jumping in the water now gave us a moving mass casualty incident to treat. You had a ship crashed at the dock. Now you have people floating down the river at 8 or 10 miles an hour that you have to try to swoop down and rescue.
Well, maybe some of them were diving for diamonds when that.
I'm sure there's a few down there still today.
Ended up in the drink. Who knows? I'm being facetious. That's just incredible. Yeah, that's another thing. Who would think that now you got a water rescue as well? And of course, that's Kevin's area. Can you imagine that, Kev?
That would be. I'll label that as fun. And I'm being facetious when I use the word fun.
No, you loved it when you were doing it. But yeah, that's a whole different dynamic that requires a whole different group of people, I would expect.
And it was over.
Sorry,
I was just going to say it was over such a large area. I mean, because just like side swiping a car, this ship drug its way along the entire dock area. So you had such a large area to search and try to gather people and move them into one area so that you could actually do a good organized triage. Getting a head count alone was so difficult.
Well, yeah. I mean, you had an area full of transients. So you had a hotel, you had a mall. You didn't know how many shoppers were in there. And so there was no way to really account for everybody.
No. To this day, it's simply, we can say that nobody was reported missing and we found no bodies. So we have to surmise there was no deaths. But just what you're saying, I mean, because of the situation, there's no way to know, because you could only guess at the number of people who were on scene.
Well, that certainly could have been a lot worse in a number of respects. These people were down lucky, is all I got to say, that they were able to get out of there.
I can tell you, one of the most vivid memories I have, and it's humorous when you look back on it, but is the front of this ship with its big name, Brightfield, stenciled on the front, and something was hanging off the bow of the ship, and we couldn't quite figure out what it was just because of the context. What it ended up being was Venetian blinds from the hotel room hanging off the bow of the ship. And you finally went, that just doesn't go.
That's not working for me.
Kevin, I was thinking, you know, you mentioned in the previous episode that, people need to train and prepare for a diverse set of incidents. And this is a perfect example of that. It's not something that you'd ever devise a scenario for before it actually happened, and probably wouldn't devise a scenario for it because it's not likely to happen again. It's just from a training aspect, this has got to be an interesting story to tell, but only maybe underlines the reason for just having a very broad and general response plan.
Exactly. You've got to be prepared as much as you can be. And a lot of that is just thinking about all the possibilities without limiting yourself to, oh, well, that'll never happen here. That will never happen to me. One of my mantras is the graveyard is full of people who said, well, that'll never happen to me. And yet it does. So you've got to be able to, think on your feet. And the more prepared you are to the more training you have, better prepares you to deal with the incident when there is no time to plan for it. When it happens like that, you don't have an hour to plan for everything. You got to act now. So the more training you have prior to that, and the more you've thought about what would I do if, will give you so much of an advantage that it'll save hours, minutes, even seconds. Especially when it comes to water, seconds count.
Oh yeah.
Because something as simple as pointing to somebody in the water and not taking your finger off of them, not just for you, but so other people who are around will also look at what you're pointing at. So the more eyes on the person in the water floating down the Mississippi, the better chance they have of somebody getting to them.
And I have to say, this is reminding me of another one of those "this will never happen" incidents. And I think it was before my time in Northern California. I think it was in the 80s, again, right at Christmas. We have a huge mall in Concord called the Sun Valley Mall. We also have a small airport nearby. And a plane, and I couldn't tell you what size it was, but it missed the airport and went right dead center into the middle of this mall. And there were deaths. There were multiple injuries in this thing. It went right into the center where Santa Claus was sitting. I mean, it was that close to Christmas. And it was a little worst case scenario. The Riverwalk sounded like these people got extremely lucky. But another one of those things you just don't think is ever going to happen. When you're close to a small airport, you know that. In fact, we've had a couple just in this last week. We've had two small planes that have disappeared. Which is kind of unusual. But when you think of something like that, again, it's like, that'll never happen. Well, guess what, folks? It did, and it will again. So your point's well made, Kevin. You got to think worst case scenario. Even if it doesn't happen, you're going to be prepared for it. So there you go.
Exactly. Plan for the worst, and you're prepared for almost anything.
That's true.
But don't have a closed mind as to this will never happen in this area, because nobody can predict the future. You never know, because it usually happens when nobody is ready for it.
They're tempting fate, in my opinion.
Well, and what Kevin says is so true. Probably the biggest thing I took from that event and others like it, and what I try to train with now, is if anything, to get across to managers and supervisors not to have one-dimensional thinking when it comes to these type of events. So many people, when they tabletop them, will pick a particular type of incident, never realizing that Murphy is never that kind to us. They never come single. That this event here that we talk about, this is a water event with a ship. So you've got it. You've got a foreign flag ship. You've got people in the water. You have a hotel and a mall with building collapse. All these different things combined all together. So you had to have so many different disciplines and abilities ready to go.
Exactly. And this took a lot of them. So, BJ, switching gears just a little bit, I'm anxious to hear about the 72-car pileup that you engaged in.
The interstate in New Orleans, I-10, as it crosses east out of New Orleans, it crosses the end of Lake Pontchartrain. If you look at the map, it's that large lake at the bottom of the state there. And there's a five-mile bridge that two lanes east, two lanes west.
I remember it well.
Well, as happens so often down here, the weather gets just so and the fog socks in. Some of the other bridges will have some sort of controls that they'll close down, but the interstate doesn't do that. And in high rush hour times with all the people moving along, there was a single car accident that initiated the incident. But we all know people tend to drive not as cautiously as they should, and this just piled on top of each other as people were unable to stop, and it just continued back for well over a mile of cars that were plowed into each other. 72 cars were what were on one side. Believe it or not, that was all on the eastbound lane. There was accidents that happened on the westbound lane due to the sounds from the eastbound lane. So they couldn't see the incident, but accidents happened with people reacting to the sounds they were hearing from it. And it was so unique because, as we continue to say, things you don't think about. We've all taken an ambulance or a police car and driven up the shoulder to get to an accident, or going a back street until we could come up the wrong way. This is on a bridge, on a five-mile-long bridge out in the middle. How do you get to it? The first unit on the scene comes up behind it, and all they can do is get out, grab their gear, and start walking and do a rolling triage. If they have walking wounded, they find them and just start sending them back and behind them in the other direction as they work their way across. My communication with the first unit on the scene, we decided that I'd go around and approach it from the other direction. So I had to cross one of the little state bridges, cross the lake that way, come at it from the other end, and do the same thing. So I was able to come all the way in until the beginning of the accident, which was a fatality at the beginning, and then begin to work my way back towards them so we could get some sort of consensus of what we had.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with those kinds of things because I live in the land of bridges. But usually it's a different jurisdiction that's on the other side because it goes across into another county.
We had the same problem. That bridge actually splits two different counties. So the logistical problems with that.
That broaches the subject, what is your communication with those other agencies that are working that other event or working the same event from the other end? You got to be able to talk to each other. Was there a problem with that?
There definitely was. The police were less of a problem because they had already had something in place. But we worked for the city of New Orleans, so we were on the city's radio communication system. The other county had a private ambulance service that they were contracted with that didn't have anything in place to communicate with us in case of this sort of emergency. So what ended up happening is someone has to stand next to them with a radio so that you could do relay communications. But there was nothing set up beforehand. Of course, it was rectified after the fact, but definitely something that should have been thought of.
So how do you set up a command post when you have that large an incident?
We ended up deciding that Yeah, pretty quickly. We put the command
boats. Wizard of roving CP.
Yeah, it basically ended up being two posts, one on each end of the bridges, because we had to shuttle people in two directions with overall command actually floating with the with my unit, who ended up at the head of the accident, basically calling once we were there, knowing that that's where it was, and we had to deal with that end of it, kind of blockading that end off and calling it the command area.
Okay. Yeah, because I can see where it could get real confusing if you have multiple agencies all trying to take control of the same incident and not communicating well with each other. When you have, did you say it was a mile from one end to the other?
The bridge is 5 miles from one end to the
other. Yeah, but the incident itself.
Yeah, the incident itself was over a mile.
Wow. So, how many patients? That's what
you stopped talking about, you know, command as far as communication. You had to run it from both sides because the people at the back of the accident turned around and walked back towards the end that they had just started on, where people at the head of the accident thought they were closer to the other shore and wanted to walk in the other direction. So you had to kind of huddle and move people around and get them where they needed to be for trauma protocol and all those other matters.
So for these walking wounded, did you just have ambulances picking them up? I mean, some of them could have been fairly far away from – somebody at least was fairly far away from the shore. So.
Yeah, what we ended up doing with that, again, an on-the-fly decision, was only one unit was allowed on both ends of the incident. We obviously – the bridges are shut down now. The interstate is completely shut down. Set all your supplies and your command at the two ends on hard ground, and then allow one unit to kind of drive in at a crawl, find your walking wounded, scoop up as many as you can, bring them back, re-triage them, and put them in individual units and send them on their way as needed. We felt that it was slower but safer, because we're still talking about being completely socked in with fog, and the last thing you wanted was multiple units running around with pedestrians all over the street.
Oh, hell yeah. Can only imagine. So how many serious and critical patients did you find? You said there was one fatality?
We had one fatality. There were at least four that ended up with intensive care time due to that, and then numerous broken bones, cuts, scrapes that went along with it.
Wow. So looking back now, what were your lessons learned on that one?
Don't drive fast in the fog. No, that's obviously
should be obvious, but it doesn't.
Should be a true lesson learned. But another one of those ones where I would have never thought of calling an MCI that was only 60 foot wide but a mile plus long. You know, you don't think that, again, trying to think out of the box, trying to do a lot more interaction with the other agencies in the area, not just the other local police agencies. One of the things that we were very lucky in that situation is I was in the military, and then after I got out, I was in the National Guard as well in Louisiana, and so was one of the other medics who was a retired Ranger, and he was able to make a phone call and find out that we had helicopters in the area, that we could bring in a military helicopter that happened to be flying in the area if we needed evac. We had never made any plans for that before. We were very lucky to have that opportunity to do that at the time, and it was something that we had to look at in the future in these emergencies to say we better have these plans laid out in advance.
Yeah, I would think in that situation you wouldn't have been able to bring any aircraft in with the fog, unless it had lifted by then.
By the time you could get into a safe area, we didn't bring them in just because we felt that the dangers it posed were higher than what we were going to gain from them. And New Orleans is one of those cities that this area, as you well know, is so remote. It's to get to downtown New Orleans from where we were at lights and sirens is 25 minutes. So
that's a long causeway.
You've got a hard and long run to get back where you need to go. So having to make sure that we have those options, making sure that you've talked to the agencies such as the hospitals. We all know how trauma protocols work in areas and wanting to get the patients, but this was the perfect example of anything that would have happened on the west side of this accident, we couldn't have gotten them to the level one trauma center. It was a physical impossibility, but we hadn't had the communications to work it out. So it worked out, but then you end up with all the fighting and arguments with administrators after the fact, as you're trying to explain why things became the way they are. And it's so much better to work this out in advance so that everybody understands what's going on.
Oh, I can't agree more. And bridges are just the devil, because most of our bridges are like yours. They only go in one direction. You can't turn around. So you could have one right at the very end of one bridge facing the wrong way, and it just makes it that much more difficult. Any thoughts on that, Kevin?
No, exactly. Again, planning is the key thing, and sometimes the trick is you don't know what to plan for, therefore you don't know how to plan for it.
Well, I think the message here is regional training, interoperability with police, with fire, with public safety, with any agency that you might interact with, making sure you have the right communication equipment, make sure you understand how an IC might be set up on a bridge. God knows, like I said, we deal with that all the time here. And we're right back to training, aren't we, Jamie? It always seems to end up there.
I think it's a good place to kind of bring this back to a close, and we can take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group. And Jim and Joe, again, aren't here for this call, or they would be chiming in with their thoughts and lessons learned on this. But, you know, this is a perfect example of why there needs to be that type of broad interoperability training that I think those guys really excel at. They go into a system and they bring together nurses and doctors from the trauma center and police officers and fire department members and EMS agency members together for a group training so that everybody gets a little bit of the flavor of what each is trying to accomplish and what their individual training levels are like. And then you put them into these stress immersion scenarios where they can kind of figure this out in a safer environment, where they can make some mistakes and it's not going to cost real lives, so that when the time comes, they're better prepared to save those lives in the real event. So contact them, thank them for supporting this show for the last 2 years, and they've already offered support for continuing to sponsor us in 2016, which we appreciate. So stop by ParagonMedicalGroup.com and say thank you, or send them a tweet over at ParagonMedEDU and let them know that you appreciate them. You'll find links to them as well over at the Disaster Podcast site at DisasterPodcast.com. And thank Paragon Medical Education Group and Dr. Joe Holly and Jim Logan and everybody else in there, that organization, for supporting the Disaster Podcast. You know, Sam, this is a great opportunity also to talk about our backup guest here today, Kevin Ryder from wildsafety.com. And Kevin, thanks for filling in. We always appreciate having you on the show. And tell folks a little bit about what you do and where they can find you.
Also, always a pleasure, Jamie, and I appreciate it. Folks can find me on the web at wildsafety.com. You can email me at training@wildsafety.com. You can find me on Twitter at Wild Safety. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram, either Wilderness Safety Institute or Wilderness Safety. A little bit about me. I also was in the military, not as a medic. The job I did encompassed a lot of that and then some, communications, medical, a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm an EMT. I do mostly training now here in Texas. I do urban preparedness, wilderness medicine, diving medicine, and a bunch of other things. But training is key. No matter what you're doing, always be training, always be learning. You'll always be prepared more than if you hadn't.
That's why we call him Wild Kevin.
Yep. And thanks for coming on the show, Kevin. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Jamie. And Sam.
And BJ, tell folks, they love these stories we've been talking about here over the last two episodes, where they can find more. You have 100 stories in this book?
This book has 100 short stories in the book. The name of the book is Welcome to New Orleans, How Many Shots Did You Hear? You can find it at my website, howmanyshotsdidyouhear.com. It's available on Amazon, Nook, and Smashwords as an electronic book. And hopefully by the time you hear this podcast, the paperback version will be available on Amazon as well.
I can't wait.
Excellent. And thanks again for coming on the show. And I know you're already in the works for working on a sequel. Is that correct?
I have 73 of the next 100 stories for volume 2.
Oh, my God.
My goal is to, we were talking about EMS Expo later on this year. My goal is to have volume 2 ready for EMS Expo so we can have both of them out and have some good stories to talk about.
Well, we're going to book you, and I know your good friend Seb Wong. We'll get him on to talk with us as well. Maybe we can have the two of you on an episode at our podcast studio at EMS World Expo in New Orleans coming up in September.
That would be awesome.
That would be scary, those two, but hey, it could be fun.
On and off air.
And Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, the usual social media places, as Kevin mentioned, I don't go down the entire list, but Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in most of those places. Certainly at the disasterpodcast.com website. And I just love these last two podcasts we did with BJ. I can't wait to hear. We only heard 3 out of the hundreds of stories this man has, so I can't wait to see what else is out there, and can't wait to get to New Orleans and meet up with him. But that's where you find me. And other than that, it'll be somewhere between California and Colorado. And at some point in time, probably in February, I will be coming to you from the Rockies.
Excellent. And we all, of course, wish you safe moving and travels to get all that squared away. I know that's quite a daunting task.
You can come out and help.
Well, it's on the other side of the country, or I would.
Yeah, good excuse, Jamie.
Well, you know, I can only be in one place at a time.
I get that. Unfortunately,
all my friends are too spread out.
Well, anyway, folks, you can find me over under the handle PodMedic in most social media places. So look me up, friend, and follow me there. And, of course, find me at disasterpodcast.com. Leave a comment on this and all the episodes that you listen to over there. If you have a question for Kevin or BJ or myself or Sam, you can leave a comment right below any of the episode articles there. And we will get back to you. It sends me an email every time you leave a comment, and I will send a blast out to the rest of the group of the people on the show for that episode, and we'll get a response for you because we want to answer your questions and we want to find out what you want to hear more about. So leave us a comment with what you liked about an episode and what you want to hear more of. Maybe we can have BJ back on before EMS World Expo to talk about some more great stories from his great collection of books.
Information, love to be on anytime.
Yeah, I know. It's been a lot of fun, and I think Joe and Jim are going to want to be on an episode with you, so we'll have to have you back.
We may not run out for years, so just saying.
Well, and you know, Sam, these two stories are perfect examples of just, you know, being prepared for anything, and how the major incidents and disasters present unique medical challenges to the responders.
And I think it also makes the point that when we talk about disasters and hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes, there's also those, it's hard to say everyday disaster because you don't have these every day, but these are in your own backyard. This is in your own regular daily work jurisdiction. So we can call it the same thing, that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.